Hi, welcome back to the Cedar 60 podcast. My name is Johnny Gartner. Thank you so much for joining us. At Cedar 60, our mission is to engage with culture and politics from the distinctive lens of the gospel. And today we're excited to have Dr. Stephen Smith on the podcast as we discuss international economic development. Dr. Smith, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate having you on.
Such a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So the topic for today, as I just mentioned, is international economic development. Before we get to that, if you want to just introduce yourself to our listeners, tell them a little bit about what you do, your educational background, we'd love to get to know you.
Thank you, and thanks for the invitation to be here. My profession is that of an economist. I'm a professor at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. I've been in Christian liberal arts for almost all of my career. I was 29 years at Gordon College and now have been 6 years, and I'm in my seventh year at Hope College. Prior to that, I taught briefly at Middlebury College. I grew up in Hong Kong, and that was a place at the time that was just bursting with economic growth and human flourishing. And it was got me interested in economic development. And that has been something I've been thinking about and writing about and talking about for my whole career.
So we use this term economic development. I think you and I probably would have a basic understanding of that and what the definition of economic development is. But maybe in a broad understanding, what is economic development?
I guess I'd describe it as the growth in the material well-being of poor populations. And, you know, there's a case to be made that growth is very important for wealthy countries, but that's a separate conversation. And economic development refers to the kinds of policies and the kinds of steps that are necessary for currently poor countries to flourish more, for families to have more resources, for more people to be educated, for there to be better health.
You talk about that word flourishing. In policy, we hear human flourishing a lot. Can you kind of talk a little bit about what are maybe some metrics that we measure human flourishing by? Because it could be kind of a broad topic.
It is very broad. But I'd be looking at it for a nation as a whole, looking at things like significant reductions in crime, significant reductions in subsistence level poverty over time, significant improvements in everyone's access to education and to health, whether that's provided by the state or provided by the market, but access to affordable healthcare, all this occurring in ways that are mindful of environmental damage and are concerned about not destroying the earth in the course of trying to assist human well-being.
Absolutely, I think hinted at it a little bit there when you're saying, taking care of the world as we develop. What does a Christian faith provide in terms of an understanding of the role of human development and why it's important?
So I think the Christian faith offers a number of distinctive things. For one thing, Christianity encourages us to approach people as image bearers of God. We believe that there's a fundamental human dignity that each individual carries, and that's inalienable. Looked at that way, material deprivation is a real problem. It's degrading. It doesn't befit the appropriate dignity of the person. And so I find it really interesting and compelling that Christians through the ages, in addition to ministering to humanity's spiritual needs, have almost always also wanted to minister to people's material needs. And of course, from a Christian point of view, the material world is good. Some people may be called to poverty, and of course, greed is a sin. But But appropriately enjoying the material world is actually part of God's intended order for humankind. And so there's Christians in missions contexts and in other contexts have always wanted to address material poverty as well as other as well as more spiritual issues.
I think we'll get into this in our conversation a little bit later, but talking about Christians, yeah, I think Christians, especially in the United States, are among the most generous people group in the world in terms of, you know, giving out of, you know, their own wealth voluntarily. I'm trying to think of the word that is to describe that. Charitable donations. I think charitable donations are among the highest in the U.S. I don't know if you have a comment on that.
I know that you're pointing to something very real. Arthur Brooks at American Enterprise Institute has done some of the best research on this in the past decade, and there's no question that Christians in the United States are among the major supporters of private charity and private development assistance globally and domestically. I might add that Americans in general have been leading in private philanthropic efforts in development. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and other private initiatives have done some good work.
So you just made an important clarification there between private giving, and then there's a lot of public policy aspect of development also. So we've kind of talked a lot about like the different aspects of development. So what is your focus on in your study of development?
Much of my research has been focused on the intersection between what I would call trade policy analysis, looking at countries' commercial policies, their trade policies, how they integrate themselves or not with the rest of the world. The links between that and changes and improvements in poverty and income distribution in countries.
So, go ahead. My bad.
The record here is actually really, really clear. Countries that have been willing to integrate globally have almost always done much better than countries that have not wanted to integrate globally. And connection with trade, allowing foreign investment, allowing citizens to travel, these things have real payoffs in long-term prosperity.
So we talk about prosperity versus poverty. Maybe you could define for us what poverty is in an international sense, and then talk a little bit about how development works to get people out of poverty, maybe in the aspect of trade, which is your focus, but maybe some of those other aspects as well.
Sure. The poverty in some of the poorest countries in the world is at a level that Americans find hard to fathom. It's what can only be described in some places as real subsistence poverty. People on the edge of starvation at times. People on living on $2 a day or the equivalent of $3 a day, at that kind of level. Now, there's a lot of stress and a lot of work involved in piecing together life at that kind of poverty level. The good news is that the past 50 years or so have seen the most dramatic global reduction in subsistence level poverty ever, and number of countries, India and China in particular, but a number of other countries have done some important things to bring large elements of their populations out of that type of subsistence level poverty into something that's much a much higher level of income and with significant material benefits to them. But there remain countries where poverty is deeply entrenched and really problematic. Now, there's many things to talk about, but one key thing is the creation of jobs inside of an economy. Work is an aspect of human dignity, and a good job, honest labor, is a terrific way out of poverty for most people. But it requires an environment in which a government is providing the infrastructure that allows jobs to be created, the rule of law, openness to trade, the legal specialization and exchange. These are the kinds of things that can allow entrepreneurship to flourish and can allow jobs to be created by small firms as well as large firms, and growth can occur and people work and flourishing ensues.
So you talked about work being a really important part of human flourishing. I think there's a biblical argument to be made for the value of work in who God designed us to be. But I think what I'd love to focus on is kind of the role that government has played over the last 30 or 40 years in helping create these things. Because if you look at a map of international development over the last, 100 years, in the last 30, 40 years, there's been a massive spike in, kind of the reduction of poverty, the increase in jobs, increase in businesses growing overseas. So if you could maybe start with why that is the case, that there's been such a spike over the last several decades, and then we can talk about what the role of the government has been in those.
So there's, for the poorest countries, there's two reliable ways of generating employment. One is to invest in domestic agriculture and reform domestic agriculture, perhaps through a land reform that like the U.S. instituted in East Asia at the end of World War II, where land is literally passed over to the tenant farmers who are farming it, and sharecropping is essentially eliminated. That frees farmers to invest in their land. They reap the full reward of owning land and the full benefit of investing capital in it. And you can get a flourishing agricultural sector that is the basis of some good job growth and then industrial growth. The other way from extreme poverty to get growth is to connect with the global economy and the ability to use low-skilled workers to produce low-tech goods for sale abroad can really drive employment creation and wealth creation. As workers gain experience, they can earn higher wages, and wages and higher incomes can drive investment in education and this can be done by households. It doesn't have to necessarily be done by government. And so you get a virtuous circle, a virtuous cycle emerging, and prosperity can emerge. I mean, this is basically the story of the early story of East Asian industrial development. In this point of view, governments do best if they help facilitate access to education, if they help facilitate access to credit, and if they don't try to do things that would harm the ability of the economy to provide lots of employment for low-skilled workers. Governments sometimes in their hurry to move development forward will adopt pretty grandiose plans for investments in high-tech industries, with dreams of a prosperous future where the country, the previously poor country, is now building airplanes, say, or semiconductors. That's sometimes those plans get really get too far advanced, too far ahead of reality on the ground, and can damage development because they require resources that the country doesn't yet have.
Yeah,
there's a kind of ladder to this.
I think this is a domestic example, kind of what you're talking about. Earlier you mentioned there's some other non-economic functions of the government to help economic development, like the rule of law and having stable judicial systems. And I think often in American culture, where there's just prominent economic theory that spending money will help generate economic productivity, that necessarily isn't always the best way to move forward. And I'm sure you could speak to how developing countries really experience that.
No, that's well worth thinking about, because there's a number of developing economies where it's fair to say that the state is overreaching in some areas and underreaching in other areas. Mm. Lack of rule of law is now, in my judgment, really hampering the growth of the Chinese economy. They're at a level where they want domestic investors to invest in firms, but without a free press, you really can't have proper assessment of good investment opportunities and bad investment opportunities. The state is sitting on top of the press. It's using the power of the state and state-owned firms to shape economic outcomes, and I don't think that's going to end very well for China. They're at a moment where that's going to become increasingly difficult, I think, and increasingly costly in terms of foregone growth. It's a funny thing. Many developing countries really love to have state-owned airlines, and those can become sinks for much of the 2010s. Thailand was losing $1 million a day running Thai International Airways, and at the same time, complaining that there wasn't enough money really to fund police and go seriously after anti-trafficking tasks. Mm. There's that juxtaposition. Governments are essential for the administration of justice, for fighting human trafficking, and really living into the rule of law in society. They're less important when it comes to owning firms.
There's two points I want to talk about in your answer there, which was brilliant. The first one is that as Americans, I think we conceive of the rule of law as just being a permanent establishment of society, and that's absent in a lot of countries, especially in developing countries. And then the other aspect would be that there's the role of government in helping shape economic development, but then there's also the role of government in bringing down economic development. So if you could talk about some circumstances where the government fails to help countries develop because of their role in trying to achieve development.
So a number of states, the governments are best described as, I'll use the term that Acemoglu and Robinson made famous in their recent set of books, Why Nations Fail and the Narrow Corridor. There are governments that are intent on extracting economic resources from the population. And this kind of activity can be slathered in all kinds of rhetoric about promoting advanced industries for the country and how important that is, and making sure that foreigners don't take the natural resource wealth of the country. At the end of the day, these are governments that are enriching insiders and choosing policies that make it difficult for outsiders to do well. And for those who aren't the beneficiaries of the extraction to do well. This is a problem with a number of the current failed states around the world. The governments that have done best are the ones that have been willing to see new industries, see new investment come, and challenge incumbent firms, even politically well-connected incumbent firms, that have been willing to work hard to get credit into the hands of the poor and the middle class, and and have really paid attention to questions of civil justice. You know, really, this was the secret of Hong Kong's success.
I think it's fair to say that the advent of this kind of globalist view of economics led to the construction of a lot of what we call multilateral organizations like the United Nations or the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. Could you talk a little bit about the role they've played in helping countries successfully develop and also helping prevent developing countries from spiraling down towards that kind of extraction style development like you were talking about?
You bet. And there's something of a mixed bag here. Both the IMF and the World Bank have endured severe criticism. And some of it, I think, has been merited, but some of it not so much. You know, the IMF is often vilified for the kinds of conditionality it places on the loans that it's willing to make. But the countries that find themselves in situations that where they need emergency lending from the IMF are often countries who have made significant policy mistakes. They've kept an overvalued exchange rate for far too long and have therefore harmed for a decade, perhaps, their exporters, who, in the face of a highly valued currency, find that it's harder to sell goods abroad. The current problems in Sri Lanka, where they are still working out access to funds from the global community to repair their economy. Sadly, much of that, if not all of it, was the result of unforced policy errors, particularly with respect to agriculture and a desire to switch immediately to organic farming, which had really disastrous consequences in 2019, 2020, and 21. Now, there were some other external factors that also affected them. The World Bank has done some tremendously good things abroad, but I have to say the record of aid long term is just really problematic. It's the nature of the World Bank that's lending to governments or to fund government approved projects, various kinds, and it gets deeply entangled with corrupt regimes. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to direct aid in the best possible ways. I've been persuaded by Dambisa Moyo's argument that official development aid, not necessarily private aid at all, has been a real problem in retarding the development of better African government policy.
I want to come back to the private aid, but for a brief moment, we've seen a shift in the last 6, 7, 8 years in public opinion in America on its role in the global stage in supporting and prompting economic development overseas. If you could talk a little bit about what the issues have been that have prompted that, and maybe what a forecast on what the future of economic development looks like.
I think there's been, 70 some years on since the foundation of the World Bank and its associated institutions, I think there's some legitimate tiredness with aid. Some people call it aid fatigue. There's a whole industry now a development industry that assists in the sending of funds from the World Bank or USAID in the bilateral aid agencies into developing countries, and there are some legitimate horror stories, unfortunately, in how this has worked out. And so I can't blame the American public for turning a little sour on this. However, I think that the public continues to overestimate how much the U.S. spends on aid, and by a large factor. And I think I would recommend that the U.S., which is a big-hearted country, I think, I would recommend that the U.S. think about refocusing its aid and not necessarily reducing it. There are ways to spend money that will help the world. The U.S. could do a lot to help facilitate the development of better vaccines, for instance. There's a brand new malaria vaccine, which is a wonderful thing to celebrate, but it's got relatively modest effectiveness, and there's plenty of room for doing more research there. A moonshot there to improve that vaccine and to really properly eliminate malaria from Africa, that would be something the U.S. could lean into and do a lot of good with. There's other things like that we could point to. So I would certainly hope and advocate that the U.S. wouldn't pull back from a global engagement with aid.
You know, we started this conversation talking about how Christians should view aid, the role of promoting human flourishing, as a fundamentally biblically based idea that human beings were created to flourish. And we've talked about private institutions and their effort to develop international economies as being separate from the government. In what ways can Christians, you know, give charitably towards organizations that can more specifically target those kinds of initiatives that you were talking about to make that economic development more real for people more readily?
You know, there's so much that can and I think should be done. And let me say, all the ideas I'm about to talk about in a second, I don't mean to say that Christians should neglect important uses of funds here domestically in the U.S. There's a number of really fine charitable Christian charitable organizations that make really good use of private dollars. I think, for instance, of International Justice Ministries, which has a terrific model of working with lawyers in developing countries to help countries enforce their own laws about civil justice. That's turned out to be a very effective way to combat human trafficking in places like Thailand and India, and other parts of the world. I think of places like Hope International or World Vision, which engage in really long-term, holistic development projects, where it's not hit and run with a dump of U.S. dollars. It's real long-term engagement in communities. And Hope International does microfinance, but it's really re-envisioned microfinance as along the lines that Brian Fickert at Covenant College has advocated, and others of really helping the poor get access to small amounts of credit and have a place to save. Secure savings turns out to be a pretty important deal for raising people's well-being.
Well, thank you so much for talking about this. I think maybe we're going to give you 60 seconds to just kind of say anything you would like to say about the topic, but I think as we look at this issue, it's really important to understand. It's hard for us maybe in you know, plushy American classrooms and businesses to think of, like you mentioned, just absolute depravity that some people live in. And so we are called to, you know, give generously to the poor. And so you've laid out some really exceptional ways to do that, not just privately as we engage in culture, but also for people who are thinking about careers in public service. So now the last 60 seconds are yours to speak freely as you wish.
Thank you. The biblical admonition to never tire of doing good. I think those are words to live by. And I appreciate that there are problems in helping our global neighbors, and that it's important to not neglect our local neighbors. Mm. I really mean that. But I think there's room for Christians to have a vision for both caring for local communities and for caring for outsiders and those abroad. Many of whom are Christians. There are millions of Christians in China and in India, and brothers and sisters of ours in faith in Indonesia and in Africa. As part of the Church Universal, I think we need to do our best to assist them. Thank you. That might not have been 60 seconds, but that's what I'd say.
Oh, no, it's excellent. I think it's important to note that it's not a call to socialism in any means. It's a call, you know, to be faithful with the resources that God has given us,
right,
and steward them,
right,
for the benefit of not just our neighbors, like you talk about, which is extremely important because we are intimately connected with them, but also for our fellow brothers and sisters and people who may have never heard the gospel before. And by living in a country where we send money that can develop, become more receptive to the gospel. So I think that's an equally important aspect, like you were talking about.
Exactly. You know, the work of private NGOs is not without great challenges. Mm. It behooves people to be thoughtful and careful about how they give abroad. I'm a big believer in visits abroad, which can be enormously eye-opening for all of us. But there really are good things that individuals can do.
Well, Dr. Smith, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We really appreciate you sharing your insights, your thoughts with us on this week's episode.
My great pleasure. Thank you so much for this invitation.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the Cedar 60 podcast. We hope you'll join us next time as we continue to engage with culture from the distinctive lens of the gospel. Thank you so much.